heard someone say something like this. Well, if God is real, why doesn't God just do something today? Why doesn't God do something now, dramatic, big, to prove he is real? The point is, if God just pulled off miracles today, like God pulled off miracles in the Bible, everyone would believe in him. You know, parting the Red Sea again, some amazing signs in the heaven, ending war, curing cancer, letting the Brewers win the World Series, some amazing sign. If only God did that, then everyone would believe. It would be so simple. It's like the wonderful song from Jesus Christ Superstar where King Herod sings to Jesus, "Prove to me that you're no fool, walk across my swimming pool." Now, I am a classically trained Lutheran pastor we are saved by God's grace through faith and not by works or anything like that. You know the stuff. But you know what? Sometimes in my life I said, "Oh, Lord, couldn't you just do that? Couldn't you just give us some signs? It would make my job so much easier if you just do that." And when people think they have seen signs, they love it. And we hear about these every once in a while in the news. You know, a statue of the Virgin Mary in some church starts to cry. Or the famous experience in Fatima in Portugal in 1917, where thousands of people claim to have seen some amazing sign in the heavens. Or every once in a while, someone will find a picture of Jesus miraculously on their French toast. And I'm not kidding you about that one. People love that sort of thing. But God has not pulled off a second Red Sea, and God has not given me a divinely inspired breakfast item. So as of now, we live by faith and not French toast. But the Gospels make one thing very, very clear, and that is this, that Jesus of Nazareth was well known for doing all sorts of amazing, miraculous deeds. Jesus, during his ministry, by both friends and enemies, was acclaimed as a miracle worker, an exorcist, a healer, someone who had powers that the ordinary average person did not have. And often, almost every time when Jesus used those powers, people ended up scratching their heads and saying, "Who is this guy?" It's interesting that the Bible never refers to these things as miracles. They are never called miracles in the Bible. They are called mighty deeds or deeds of power. Or in John's Gospel, our text for today, they are called signs. In John's Gospel, Jesus does 7 signs. He heals the son of an official in Capernaum, where most of his ministry was based, who was very ill. He healed a paralyzed man, a crippled man, who was lying by the pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. He fed the 5,000 people with just a few fish and a few loaves on the hillside in Galilee. And then right after that, he walked on the waters and calmed the storm on the Sea of Galilee, the shortest of his signs in John's Gospel. In chapter 9, a story that takes the entire chapter, Jesus heals a man in Jerusalem who had been born blind. And finally, in chapter 11 of John's Gospel, Jesus performs the greatest of his signs. He raises his friend Lazarus from the dead. But before Jesus did any of those signs, he did his first sign at the wedding in Cana in Galilee. And the story is found in chapter 2 of John's Gospel. And it begins with these words, "On the third day." On the third day. So we ask, on the third day after what? Well, probably on the third day after Jesus had been baptized by John the Baptist. And on the 2 days after Jesus had started gathering his disciples, because we're told by the time this story happens, he's got a couple of disciples. He's got Andrew, he's got Simon, whom we all know as Peter, and he has Philip, and he has Nathanael. And having just met Jesus by the rivers of the Jordan, they now go together to this town called Cana in Galilee to a wedding. They go back to Jesus' home ground. So, there's a wedding in Cana of Galilee. And Jesus' mother has been invited there, and Jesus and his disciples have been invited as well. Now, we do not know who the bride and groom were. We do not know how they knew Jesus and Mary. And we also don't know how Jesus was able to finagle an invitation long after the RSVPs would have been required to have been turned in. But they are all at the wedding. And we need to know something else about weddings in Jesus' day. wedding receptions could go on for several days. Back in a time when people's lives were so very ordinary, weddings were the neatest thing they have. In fact, when Jesus talks about what heaven is like, his number one image of heaven is it is like a wedding banquet. And we also need to know this about the wedding receptions in Jesus' day. They're not like receptions today, okay? They do not have the pre-drinks, you know, the time to drink. And then you don't have the procession of the wedding party coming in like that. And then you don't have the buffet followed by dancing. These parties were long-term deals lasting 4 days. And in the middle of this wedding reception, the unthinkable happened. They ran out of wine. How bad is that? Imagine a wedding reception in 2019, and suddenly the father of the bride has to stand up and poke the microphone and said, "Excuse me, everyone, but you drank it all. There's nothing left." That's what's going on. And there must have been whispers going all around this wedding reception, because Jesus' mother hears what's going on, and she says to Jesus, "They have no wine." And Jesus' response is rather interesting. He says, "Woman, what concern is that to you and me?" Explanation note, Jesus wasn't being rude when he called her woman. That's how Jesus always addressed women in John's gospel. I just want you to know he's a good son, okay? Back to the story. "Woman, what concern is that to you and me?" And then he says, "My time has not yet come." Okay, spoiler alert. When does Jesus' time come? I'll tell you that in a couple of minutes, okay? Just get ready for that. Back to our story. My time has not yet come. But Mary, instead of being insulted that her son is treating her that way, she says to the wedding steward, she says, "Oh, just do whatever he tells you." And Jesus, being a good son, tells them something. We are told that at the wedding reception, there are large stone jars. In Judaism at this time, stone jars were used for ritual of purification because stone could not become impure where pottery and other items could. They're large. They hold 20 to 30 gallons of water. And so Jesus says to the servants at the wedding, "Fill them all up." So they fill them all up. And then he says, "Draw some out and take it to the steward." Now, the chief steward is the guy at the wedding. At this time, he's going like this because everything is tanking and it is all his responsibility and he will take the blame. And so the stewards bring him some of the water now turned to wine, even though he doesn't know it. He takes a drink, and he is amazed. And he calls the bridegroom to him, and he says, "Well, everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you kept the good wine until now." And I will admit, that is one of the funnier lines in the Bible. The Bible's not known as a book of humor, but I like them. It's like saying, you know, you're supposed to serve the good stuff first, and when everyone's drunk, then you bring out the Thunderball and the Mad Dog 2020, okay? "But you kept the good stuff until now." Now, it's not a super big miracle, is it? Not a super big sign, but I couldn't do it. It's hardly to the level of healing a blind man or raising someone from the dead. And you could think of it as kind of a warm-up sign, kind of like spring training where you get ready before the real games start. And scholars have tried to come up with all kinds of reasons and explanations for why this story is there. But we know this. John included it in his gospel, so it's important. And at the end of the story, John adds this last line. "Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him." Three things in that sentence I want to talk about. First, it's the first of his signs. Second, it revealed his glory. And third, his disciples believed in him. So let's talk about those. First thing, it was the first of his signs. There were more to come. Jesus didn't stop there. He was just beginning. And as the gospel goes along, there will be six more signs. And each one of the signs will tell us a bit more about Jesus. And each one of the signs will also leave people scratching their heads or upset or leaving Jesus or coming closer to Jesus. Second thing, it revealed his glory. John's gospel is all about glory. The gospel begins with this beautiful prologue, this hymn to Jesus, the incarnate word of God. It says this in chapter 1. "And the word became flesh," that's Jesus, "and he lived among us, And we have all seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Jesus' ministry will slowly reveal his glory and the glory of God to the world. Jesus' life and his ministry will point people toward the glory of God. His signs will help reveal the glory of God. In chapter 8, in a story where Jesus is in the temple in Jerusalem and people are saying he's possessed by an evil spirit, he says, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and yet I do not seek my own glory." Said Jesus, "It's not just about me." And Jesus never sought acclamation or even acknowledgement of his deeds. Very often he told the person he healed, "Shh, don't tell anyone. Just go home and keep it to yourself." And Jesus was glorified when his heavenly Father was glorified. Later in chapter 11, when he gets word that his dear friend Lazarus is ill, Jesus says, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Jesus used Lazarus' death to show the true power and glory of God. When Lazarus was raised from the dead, you would think raising someone from the dead would get everyone to go, "Whoa, look at this guy. He really is who he says he is. Who else can raise the dead?" You would think Jesus and God would certainly be glorified when Jesus raised his friend from the dead. But in one of the great ironies of history, Jesus' raising of Lazarus only leads to Jesus' death. Because after Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, the Jewish leaders are afraid that he will be so popular that everyone will go over to Jesus' side. He will lead a rebellion against the Romans, and the Romans will come and destroy everyone, including the religious leaders. So Jesus had to die. As the chief priest said, "It is better for you to have one man die for the people than to have the whole nation destroyed." Jesus had to go. Power and glory are not. He was too dangerous. And in an even more ironic twist, Lazarus had to go as well. Lazarus, who had just died and been raised, has to die again because he's a dangerous witness of Jesus. It's only in chapter 12, the next chapter, when Jesus is in the temple in the last days of his life, when some Greeks appear seeking Jesus, that he says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And how will he be glorified? By suffering and dying. That is Jesus' ultimate glory, dying to save the world. The third thing we hear in that last verse from our gospel is this, that his disciples believed in him. But the question is, believed what? They'd only known him for a day or two. What could they possibly know or believe about Jesus? That he's a guy who could save a dying party? That he had some interesting powers, that maybe we should check it out some more, that maybe he's worthwhile hanging around and getting to know, that he is the Messiah, and if he is the Messiah, what kind of Messiah is he? We're not told exactly what they believe. And believe is a very interesting word again in John's gospel. It's used a number of times through the gospel, but in terms of people sort of maybe catching on a little bit, but not fully understanding who Jesus is. Later on in chapter 2 in John's gospel, Jesus goes to Jerusalem, and we're told he did some signs there. We're not told what they are. But John says this, "And when he was in Jerusalem during the Passover, many believed in his name because they saw the signs that he was doing." And that sounds really positive. That sounds like we're on the right track, but not quite. Because John then says this, "But Jesus, on his part, would not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to testify about anyone, for he himself knew what was in everyone." Jesus didn't trust the crowds. Why? Because the crowds love the wow factor. When Jesus feeds the multitudes in chapter 4, what do the crowds want to do? Make Jesus king. Why? Because it's free bread. We want this guy to be our king. And so Jesus actually sneaks away and leaves them because that's not the kind of belief he wants. Chapter 9, after he's healed that blind beggar, the beggar stands before Jesus and Jesus says, "Do you believe in the Son of Man, Son of God?" And he says, "Who is he that I may believe?" And Jesus says, "You're looking at him." And that man slowly takes the steps to faith. But he's not there yet. And even on Easter, When that beloved disciple runs to the tomb and looks in and sees it's empty, we are told that he saw and believed, but we're also told that he didn't truly understand what the scripture said. It is only on Easter, when Jesus appears to his disciples, and only a week later when he appears to that delightful character we call Doubting Thomas. And Thomas falls on his knees before Jesus as Jesus says, okay, put your hands in the holes, but don't doubt but believe. And when Thomas finally utters, my Lord and my God, Jesus says, Thomas, do you believe because you've seen? Well, blessed are those who haven't seen and yet have come to believe. It takes the resurrection to come to full belief in Jesus. And that process of belief goes all the way back to our story today, to that wedding in Cana in Galilee. Jesus's miracles, his signs were part of that process of coming to believe in him, but they were not the whole process. And so often, as in Jesus' time, as today, friends, and we have to be honest about this, our question of who is this guy is colored by our own preconceived notions of who we want him to be. That was true in Jesus' day. It's true today. So, how do we summarize this wonderful little story? Who is this guy? Well, Jesus is the man of signs and power. He is the one who defeated hunger, paralysis, blindness, and the grave. He is the one who held the power of nature in his hand. He is the man from Galilee, fresh from the Jordan River, who could save a wedding feast that had run out of wine. He was that, and he is so, so, so much more. He is above all and after all, the one who gave himself for you and for me. And why would he do that? Why would he do such a crazy thing? Because of the love he has for all of us. When the Jewish leader Nicodemus stood before Jesus, confused about being born again, Jesus said, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." Jesus' life, his ministry, his mighty deeds, his signs are all testimonies to God's great love for us. You know, it would be pretty cool if God did something amazing right now. But he does, in great ways and little ways. And it would be really cool if God would knock our socks off. But whenever anyone says that to me, here's what I respond. Well, he's already given his Son to die for us. How are you going to top that?